philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Negative. I am a meat popsicle.
Mindless philosopher, you overweight glob of grease.
I'm gonna have to science the shit out of this.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 30, nice round number. And to celebrate round numbers, because they're, you know, worth celebrating, I think, to the extent that we have a guest on, Noah Illusions. How are you doing, Noah?
I was doing good until you said round number. What does that mean to you, Thomas? What is a round number?
Oh, he gets how this game works. Yeah. Somebody showed up to play.
That's awesome. Aaron, how's it going? How are you doing?
Dude, my avatar is fully chromed out. I am neon green, blue, like... can I get a keytar solo, Brian? I think that's what I need here.
Oh, I'm excited to talk about this. And we've got to get your pizza to you in 30 minutes or less. Otherwise, we...
Oh, man, I love it all. To death.
We read Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. This was pretty long book, unless I'm just not a book person. This is by far
the shortest Stephenson I've ever read, I think. Like, it's like half the length of most of his books, yeah.
Yeah, it's like an order of magnitude.
Yeah, right.
It's a novella by Stephenson.
I told you I'm not a book person, okay?
Why do you
for
do
me,
this
I understand
podcast?
It was longer than the kids' menu at Denny's, which is...
I can see why you guys did Harrison Bergeron now. I can see why you settled on
this. Yeah. Took me 4 months to get through.
The secret of this show is Audible, because he's functionally illiterate. It's all the hockey.
I will say, this is one that, like,
read.
When you do it on Audible, it's a very different book because of all those creepy-ass the speaking in tongues shit between
okay,
the chapters.
Are we going to do this? Because this might be an After Dark topic, but I'm curious if, like, how racist the Audible recording it. Like, it's...
Oh, no.
It's pretty racist, but I don't, like, or is am I racist? I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't, we'll save that.
It can be both.
It could be both. But let's set up this world. I think we could do, you know, we've got so much to talk about, and we've got three people, which means I'm sure we'll have plenty to say, which means we're probably packing this into two episodes. So let's start with this world building and talk about the libertarian wet dream that is Snow Crash, because I really, you know, Noah, you kind of gave this recommendation to me, you and Eli, I think, and I wanted to check it out, and I love the first few chapters and just the how it describes the world. Do you want to start us off on setting it up?
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
Yeah, sure. I think that this book may have the best, like, opening three pages of anything I've ever read, right?
It's so funny.
So we start off in a world that is, I don't know when, it's like a near future setup. After a giant war, the United States is more or less dissolved and been replaced entirely by gated communities and franchise city-states and whatnot called burbclaves. So basically, we've got a world here where everything is outsourced. You've got several different private armies that are contracting for national defense. You have, and we should point out, by the way, this was written in 1992, which you have to keep reminding yourself over and over again, because Stephenson was so far ahead of the curve, you know, when the internet was still just still photos of naked women and message boards. He was seeing so far ahead. But so you've got the actual world, which is ever more divided, and then you've got the digital world, which he calls the metaverse, which is sort of the unifying force within this universe. So the story follows our main character by the name of Hero Protagonist, and his sidekick YT, which stands for Yours Truly, and as they sort of adventure through and try to solve a potentially world threatening disaster involving nuclear weapons and Sumerian mythology.
Yeah, and I love the way he is able to convey so much information about the world. That's really one of the tricks of good writing that I couldn't even begin to fathom how to do, but it's fun to read, which is to convey all this information about the world, but in a way that's kind of natural. You know, like, you'll see a crappy show sometime where it's like, hey, tell us about basically all the exposition of this world in an unnatural way, using things you would never say to another person.
You mean like the first half of our episodes?
Yeah. Exactly. That is the key to the exposition zone.
I think so much of the skill of a sci-fi writer is how they handle the info dump. Now, this book has like a 90-page info dump in the middle, right?
True,
when we start talking about like sort of the Sumerian mythology stuff and the linguistics
stuff.
He sort of
lost patience in the middle. He's like, just whatever, upload. Just
the architect shows up. Fourthly.
Exactly. But in the beginning, it's perfect. Like for me, it's as well done as it could be, especially like you're saying, especially with sci-fi, because it's always such a departure from our current reality that you have to do so much work to try to make it be a natural way of setting up a very unnatural world.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love it because the way he does it is he's got Hero Protagonist, you know, he's what's called the Deliverator.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. Every time I think about it, it's funnier to me. In this future everything's corporate, basically. Everything's a corporation, like to extents that you wouldn't even
Like the mafia is incorporated. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The mafia. And, you know, the mafia is also the ones in charge of the pizza delivery. And in this futuristic world, libertarian wet dream, where it's all about essentially like customer service is key because it's all corporations. If you don't get your pizza delivered in 30 minutes, I think, or is it 20? I think
30,
it's 30.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 30 or less, then like the it's like the end of the freaking world.
No, the customer gets to beat you to death. That's the deal. You get your pizza in 30 minutes or the customer gets to beat the delivery driver to death. Yeah.
Well, and like the Enzo, probably my favorite character, Enzo, the head of the mafia, he also has to like show up at your mm-hmm. house, and like there's news coverage and stuff. And so as such, this person in this really important coveted position of pizza delivery guy called the Deliverator has like all these high-tech weapons and like an armored car and like has like special passports and stuff for delivering pizza. I just loved that setup. I enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, and it's such a send-up of the cyberpunk genre, which was really still fairly young, you know, maybe 6-7 years of really having a fully fleshed out genre. And he was already lampooning it in 92, which I thought was brilliant.
Right, because all of that fancy tech, and the guy immediately drives his thing into a ditch, basically. He drives into a pool. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating as a send-up. So what's next? What happens?
All right, so yeah, so he's delivering he's trying to deliver his pizza. He gets in trouble, but luckily there's a courier by the name of YT, Yours Truly, who is a 15-year-old girl who could have been an 18-year-old girl and made this book way less uncomfortable.
Why? I had the same thought. Give me 17.
Or 16 with parental consent in Texas. You know.
Yeah. It was really frustrating to me. It was like, why? I mean, I know 1992, slightly different time.
I have a theory. No, I mean, my theory is that as a send-up of libertarianism, mm-hmm. Feeling is at any moment this book is going to turn towards you and be like, actually, it's called hebephilia. And like, it's kind of a social construct, really.
Yeah.
Like, feels like that. And I'm hoping that that's a satire and not Neal Stephenson doing a Louis C.K. on us. Like,
yeah, it's weird. That part was a little frustrating.
I think we should save the discussion of the underage activities for after dark.
We are going to save that discussion.
Press right on.
Yeah, but I think it leads you into a really interesting talking about, like, sort of when he creates this libertarian world, he doesn't shy away from the bad, and he also isn't afraid to make some good out of it as well, right? So, like, yes, the customer service is way better, you know, the downside of which being if you're an employee, you might get beaten to death for being 2 minutes late with your pizza. But also he's got, like, you know, in these burb claves, some of them are like white supremacy burb claves where black people can't go. Some of them are black supremacist burb claves where white people can't go. So he doesn't try to make it into a paradise by any stretch of the imagination, right?
Well, yeah, he's not like Ayn Rand or something, is he? I don't know the guy. Do you know? Does anybody know his personal kind of politics?
Yeah, I don't get the impression that he's totally in favor of any of this.
I've got to say, like, I've read enough of his work that I think there's definitely some strong libertarian leanings that probably got less strong after 1992. If you read Cryptonomicon, there's definitely a libertarian flavor to that as well. So I don't know. I don't think I could speak to his personal politics, but I think that the book was a satire of a lot of things, and it was definitely a satire of pure libertarianism. But I don't think that you can, you know. But I do think that he still had, like, you know, very strong feelings about, like, cryptocurrency and whatnot. We should mention some of the ways that this book has been influential in the growth of the internet and whatnot, because I think you can really trace cryptocurrency back to this book in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and maybe let's point out, like, we mentioned that the government isn't quite there anymore, but it is sort of there, and like, I think you're right that you can see some sympathy toward the libertarian by seeing his account of the American government and also the raft.
My favorite part.
Let's throw in those pieces.
I know this is out of order, but it's a minor detail. My favorite part related to that is the end. When, like, the president is there, nobody knows.
Yes, right.
It's so funny.
Yeah, the American government in this is just turned into bureaucratic busy work that does practically nothing. Yeah.
Right. And the president, just nobody cares about the president. He's, like, in the room and they're like, huh, what? Who's this?
Shut up. We have corporate leaders in the room. Yeah, which is, you know, again, 92. He saw it coming. Okay, so you've got this character who's a bazillionaire that... floats around. He lives on a aircraft carrier, the USS Enterprise, and he's attached a whole bunch of different, rafts and anything that floats are attached to it. And he spends his life just circling the Pacific Ocean, picking up refugees in Asia and then dropping them off on the American coastline, basically just to provide more consumers and labor for the series of corporate entities that are the United States at this point.
Right. And I guess we're still trying to set up all the, you know, the world building of the libertarianism here. When at a certain point, I think it's after where we were, when YT gets arrested, there's this really interesting dialogue and chatter about, like, okay, well, I've been arrested by such and such, you know, corporate guards or whatever, and they won't arrest me here because they don't have the jurisdiction in this corporation or whatever. And she's wondering about what prison they're going to take her to. And it involves, you know, there's some commentary on private prisons, but then ultimately she's in trouble because, like, they've signed a deal with the other corporation. So they do have jurisdiction. And I just think all that is really funny. And it's I think it makes you think about this idea of, you know, private military or private security or private police. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that it's a good idea why we don't do that as our main source of police or protection or whatever. This idea that it's going to depend on, you know, which contracts or with whom and which entities have hired police and all that. I thought it was really interesting.
Well, and that's so much of, like, the tension in the book is developed from these various characters trying to remember what laws apply where and where they can and can't go. When she gets arrested, she's trying to talk the cops into taking her to the nicer of the private prisons that's available, you know?
Right, yeah. Oh, God, the cop dialogue is so good. It's like Idiocracy, kind of, in a way. I love the cop dialogue. They talk, everything is formed around lawsuits. Like, every word they have is chosen kind of around which ways they will get sued for something. So, like, it's all disclaimers and
yeah.
Then she at a certain point she says something to them like, let me go, or whatever. She just says something like that, you know. And then the officer says, oh, you have spoken to me in English. So that now contractually waives yes. your right to have any other language. And it's just, everything is kind of like that.
Well,
I just
think it's, you know, really, they don't want to have to go to Bob's house of law, you know, and pay a fine right. of some sort. Yeah.
I love that besides being this send up, it ties in with the philosophical stuff and with the language that we're going to get to a lot more in part two. But as like, he's giving a sort of strengths and weaknesses account of all these different political systems. And I think what he wants to say is that one of the strengths of this is that it has this crazy diversity to it. So the same thing that looks like super silly and annoying also presents a kind of shield against certain kinds of cultural takeover, basically. So I love the way that all of this is put in the context of a virus, that like that's the reoccurring motif in the libertarianism and then moving up through all the levels.
Mm-hmm.
I also think I am nowhere near any sort of expert on the history of fiction that involves, you know, virtual reality and all that stuff. But I do really for what I know, I do really feel like this portrayal of the metaverse, which is his, you know, phrase for this virtual reality that they inhabit as well. I really think it's well done. And it just seems, I don't know, it seems pretty groundbreaking to me. Again, I don't know if there's more history that I don't know about, but
yeah,
what's
it
that?
Absolutely is. He was so far ahead. We should point out, like, the fact that we use the term avatar that comes from this book.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Google Earth, the guys that created Google Earth, one of them says that Google Earth was based on the metaverse.
Because there's a certain point
later.
Based
on the Google Earth program, yeah. I think, not the metaverse.
Well, right. The which was presented as a concept within the metaverse. Yeah.
Yeah. Later right, exactly. on in the book, when he's trying to find some stuff, he has this essentially Google Earth, like it's almost called Google Earth. Like it's this close to being called Google Earth. It's really, I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, it's really funny. This in book. Another one of Stevenson's books, there's a book he did called ReamD, which was all about a guy who has a massive multiplayer online game. And he says in the book, the main character says, the boot up screen for T-Rain was, you know, basically just a ripoff of Google Earth. But he didn't feel bad about that since Google Earth had admitted they ripped that off of some old science fiction book to begin with.
Yeah.
What I was going to say about the metaverse was he sets it up, and I think it's really interesting in that even though it's a virtual environment where you would think things like space would be kind of infinite and not valuable, the way this virtual reality is set up is that under the assumption that only pretty wealthy people at the time of the book would be able to access it, because you need certain resources and computing and all that kind of thing, that advertising in the metaverse is extremely valuable. And I think that's a pretty counterintuitive thing. I mean, especially back then, I remember for the longest time, you know, I'm a little younger than you, Noah, but I remember for the longest time, it was my impression that no one really thought making money on the internet made any sense. I remember when the first mm-hmm. big thing, I think it was the first car on eBay sold, and people laughed at it. They're like, how, why? That is a joke. You would never buy something like that on the internet. And this idea that the internet is, in the book, that the metaverse is more valuable, like mm-hmm. real estate in the metaverse is almost more valuable than real estate, I found really interesting and not, you know, kind of counterintuitive. I don't think that's, you know, people definitely mm-hmm. wouldn't have been thinking in those terms back then.
Yeah, I definitely love the breaking down of the boundary between the virtual and the real, which is a classic trope of the cyberpunk stuff, but has become all of our lives right now as we are engaging in this semi-virtual activity that will be conveyed to other people via technology. I spent large parts of the metaverse thing having a lot of flashbacks to when I was deeply into World of Warcraft, and it really does presage a lot of what
yeah,
that was
well,
like.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a point I was making, too, is that when you think about these things abstractly, like World of Warcraft, where, you know, there are times, I don't think so much anymore, I never really played it that much, I played it very briefly, but there are times when, and maybe still today, people would pay real money for things in the game, like a lot of real money mm-hmm. for things in the game. And
it's a big debate in gaming now about whether it should be allowed to pay real money for things.
And you think, like, on one hand, this is just bleeps and bloops. Like, somebody could just program it. Like, if you had control of the thing, you'd just be like, dial, you know, what, loop, make infinite of that, you know, like, but when everybody comes together and agrees on certain rules, then all of a sudden it can become valuable. And like in the metaverse, when they have all these rules, like you can't pop in and out of in and out of the metaverse, except in your home. There's certain rules about appearance and height. You can't be an infinite height, you know, like you can only be certain.
Yeah. You have to be the height that you are in real life. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And I found it interesting. If you agree enough on all these rules, even though this is a totally fictitious place, but for these rules that you all agree on, things can become very valuable. And I actually think that seems pretty realistic to me. You know, in these massive online multiplayer games, if enough people are invested in these rules and don't and put in protections and rules against just creating, you know, infinite of whatever the resource is that you all want, then people will buy and trade for it and find it valuable.
Certainly the part of it that was the most plausible, like the most ring true to me, was the part in the like hacker bar where you have the area that's like the rich famous people, and the status symbols for them are the coolest looking avatars, big shiny glowy heads. And I'm like, that's exactly what happens in World of Warcraft. That is exactly what every city in World of Warcraft looks like.
Yeah, well, that's let's say Fortnite so we don't seem too old, but
sure, okay, I'll pretend that I'm not an old person.
Yeah.
I had friends who lost their careers because of that game. They died, that Nom and stuff.
I think...
I thought you were talking about Fortnite. People are losing their careers over Fortnite.
Yeah,
right
I saw an article the other day about how many times Fortnite has come up in divorce proceedings at this point and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, like, again, this was made in 92, so you just think about how far ahead he was thinking to get to these spots. But yeah, the idea that... that your skin, that your avatar would be your status symbol... again, you know, it was completely new in 92, and now it's something that we just accept. But one of the aspects of the book is that so you can access the metaverse through these public terminals. But if you do, you end up as a grainy, black and white, shitty looking avatar that everybody makes fun of. Right.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. I also really like that component, too. There's a lot of that's the good, the cool when world building is done well. It's just a series of things where, like, yeah, that would happen. Like, that does make sense, you know? That was another aspect that I really enjoyed.
And it makes for another wonderful critique of libertarianism that, like, in this idyllic, perfect possible world, you still immediately get a segregation of the culture into different, you know, socioeconomic echelons.
Yeah, and it occurs to me now that we haven't brought up the villain of the story yet, Raven. And I just want to ask, was I the only person that was thinking of, what's his name from Machete the whole time?
Holy crap.
Uh-huh.
I kind of was too. That's so Trajan. Weird. Yeah, Danny Trejo.
Yeah, Trejo. Danny Trejo. I could not think of anyone else through the whole thing. And we should point out that what makes him so badass. First of all, he has Snow Crush, which is a drug.
I want to modify this and say I was specifically thinking of his character in the Rick and Morty episode when which is called what's his name? Jaguar.
Yeah, a dash of the lead singer from Metalocalypse, if you will. The especially the neck situation, the long hair in the neck. I was thinking Metalocalypse a little bit.
All right, you guys have just completely gone way too young in your references for me. Can we talk about The Simpsons or something? Damn it. And what makes him so badass? Not only does he have access to the titular Snow Crush, which is a computer virus / drug / linguist. We'll get into all of the different things he is, but also he is a nuclear power. Right. So in the real world, he rides around on a motorcycle with a nuclear bomb next to him that is hooked to his heart. So if he dies, the nuclear bomb goes off. Right.
My favorite part of this, my absolute favorite part of this, is when I teach ethics and I talk about gun control. I'm like, I bring up the argument of, well, should people be allowed to have personal nukes? And people are like, that's absurd. And I'm like, great. Here's this snow crash. Now I can throw this right at them.
Yeah.
It's a great defense mechanism. It's perfect. No one will ever want to kill you.
Right.
Yeah, he's a walking hostage situation. But what I love about that the most is, like, even if he just, you know, a piano falls on him, then like,
yeah, right,
a whole city has to die,
and honestly,
or he just has a heart attack one
day. Isn't that like a perfect critique of libertarianism too, right? Yeah. It's all about the individual. He doesn't give a fuck what happens if a piano falls on him.
Yeah.
Or a dentata isn't just a knockout drug.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So is there, what do you want to talk about philosophy-wise here, Aaron?
Well, I mean, we've certainly hit on a lot of the major things, but I think we should just talk about sort of the strengths and weaknesses that he highlights in libertarianism versus sort of bureaucratism, which is the American government version, versus the raft, which I see as kind of a state of nature slash communism kind of thing going on there. They all sort of have their important features to them that play into this story.
One thing I wanted to touch on, I think it is going to be related, was I really love the critique. If I'm reading it right, this could be me injecting a little bit into it, but when he talks about YT's mom works for the feds, and it's so interesting because it's really this thankless job. Like I'm trying to remember. It's not like they get paid a lot, right? Don't they?
It's a job that's meant to epitomize loyalty yeah. to this organization.
Yeah, naked nationalism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also it's this idea that when it comes to the government, not always, like sometimes there's government jobs where it's like, that's cushy as hell and that's awesome. But there's certain government jobs where it's like, we don't pay these people that much. And we expect way more from them than we would for any corporate job, you know? And sometimes it could be okay, and sometimes it could be really bad. If there are really important positions in government that you would want, you know, like the top people for, then they're almost never going to take the job because a corporation could pay them so much more to be the CEO versus, you know, going and being really, really good at a government job where you'll maybe you'll make six figures, but you aren't making seven figures.
Yeah, well, say that first one's going to be a one too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that she's subject to constant, YT's mom, that is, she's subject to just constant like interrogations and lie detector tests, and like with getting injected with stuff. Like she's taking a lie detector test and then just mystery injection.
Yeah.
And it's to get her to to talk more, like
having
like
to walk upstairs. That was the worst part, I think.
And it's just, I just love it. It's another I think it makes sense in that even though everything is runaway corporate, there's an aspect of, you know, government that does exist, but it does take this incredible loyalty, and it has to be people who just have this unbelievable loyalty. Otherwise, why would they even be doing it? And it's never going to get you like the best people.
The other virtue of it, I think, is the stability. The point is, if you can be the kind of person who's able to devote yourself to this ridiculous bureaucracy, it's a stable job. And so in this book, I think it tries to point out that, you know, what works will succeed in the form of getting market shares. And so the reason the government hasn't died off completely, I think, is because there is a segment of the population that would take a boring, stable, bureaucratic job just to be consistent. And so there is that little bit of the world that still makes sense, even though it's been overcome by all this crazy other, you know, capitalist stuff. It wouldn't do well in the marketplace of ideas or the marketplace of free association, but it doesn't die off completely, which I think is a nice sophisticated critique.
Well, but I think the government has to survive in this book. And again, it was a very long book for me, so correct me if I'm wrong. But I believe the only reason the government even still exists is like nobody really cares about it. Again, nobody knows who the president is, and they don't really care about it except they had a monopoly on information, right?
Yes.
Or something.
They have the Library of Congress. Yeah.
Yeah. And
No. They have a monopoly on loyalty. That's the important thing for them, is that they're getting funded largely by folks like the bad guy, turns out,
yeah,
who is using them because their people are so reliably loyal.
Right.
They won't steal any of the ideas.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is they aren't even being a good government in any way. Like, they're essentially being a corporation now. Like, they have contracted out to just provide labor for the bad guy. You know, there's so their government kind of in name only, really.
Very prophetic, that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And then you have the raft, which I think we'll talk more about some next time, but just to sort of preview a little bit, I think symbolizes people in a state of nature, right? There's the passage that talks about the worst thing that can happen on the raft is that your area of the raft gets cut loose right. from everyone else, and you get stuck out in the ocean and starve to death. So everyone's constantly lashing their part of the raft to other parts of it.
Yeah.
I thought that was a wonderful symbol for like how yeah. human beings are constantly trying to generate important interconnections between each other to prevent them from killing each other.
Well, yeah, I like that as well.
Yeah, and there's definitely a sense there of, in throughout the book, there's sort of these explorations of different types of interconnectedness, right? So, like the mm-hmm. the U.S., the former U.S. is basically as separated as possible and still functional. But uses the metaverse to stay interconnected, and then you've got the raft is sort of like you said this impossibly inefficient method of achieving the same thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
There's a spot in there where Raven takes YT out on a date in the raft, and they're just to get from one place to another. You have to walk through people's bathrooms and their bedrooms. It's just like there is no. There's no road that takes you from one part of, and this, we should say that this raft is massive. It's a aircraft carrier with five times of the surface area of an aircraft carrier lashed to it. There are no main thoroughfares or anything like that. Now you compare that to the metaverse, like which is all built around one central road that goes all the way around this virtual planet, right?
Right.
That's a good comparison. Yeah.
It's almost like the raft needs some sort of centralized government. Coordinate.
I mean, I think, yeah. No, I think that's the main critique. Like, that's why I think you can't really see this as being a wholesale endorsement, but in fact, a satire of libertarianism.
I don't see how this is anything but a satire. Like, I'm not even seeing where it's providing any positives. I was kind of.
I think there are some people who read the parts about the Berklaves and the, like, that part of things and thinks that part of the world might be.
You mean
be okay.
The people who want to live in white nationalist Berklave?
or the people who want to live in Hong Kong Berklave and, like, love the idea of this. This system
that rises and falls entirely by
communities. That is another one of my favorite.
Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. And then I love the detail where it's not actually affiliated with Hong Kong.
No, yeah, right, right. Like,
it's just this corporate branding that he's done, and like Hong Kong has made it clear that he's not, like, no, they aren't the same country. Like, nobody can, they don't have shared citizenship or anything. It was funny.
I mean, like, what happened, right? Like, there was a restaurant. There was a Chinese restaurant in Jersey that was called Mr. Lee's Hong Kong. And then when everything fell, that became one of these empires, right? That's the backstory of these people.
Yeah,
right,
so
and
good.
Like, sort of circle back to what you were saying, Thomas, about looking for the positives in this, I think that the positive that a libertarian might take away from this is that there is a level of efficiency or a speed with which efficiency can spread through these rise and fall corporatist communities, which I think were largely inspired by gated communities. Now, have either of you ever lived in a gated community?
I have lived in something that is
my friend did, and I used to go over there all the time.
Right. So I lived in a gated community when I was in Pennsylvania for a little while, and my father comes to visit me, right? And he says, we're talking about we have our own police. They're not really police. They're just the security guards that ride around in the community. And my dad says, if they tried to pull me over, I just wouldn't pull over. They can't make me pay a fine. And I'm like, no, but they can make me pay one. Right. So, and so to see the level of efficiency in terms of, the roads being repaved, the fire department, the police, they're like literally 13 seconds away if you need them, right? Because you have your own private police force, your own private fire department, and your own private ambulance service. And the other ones don't even go out there, right? They have their own mail delivery system. Now, when you live in a place like that, you got to feel really guilty, or at least you should, because the whole reason for that to exist is, hey, if we had this much space and it wasn't privately owned, we'd have to make some poor people housing somewhere, right?
Exactly.
But yeah. I think in a lot of ways, that was the inspiration that Stevenson used, because there were actually in California, right before this was published, I can't recall the names of them, but there were several laws that were passed to sort of allow for more autonomy in these gated communities, right? And so this is just sort of like, mm-hmm. how far would that go? Now, like I said, the positive of this is that if you don't do well, your entire burbclave is just going to go under, and it's going to be replaced by, you know, Mr. Lee's Hong Kong affiliate or something that is working better. Right. So your path to efficiency is much shorter in sort of the private sector.
And this is where I think it's possible that some of the Silicon Valley guys also get on board, because I don't think the book does as good a job as it could of describing how horrible the situation in this world would be if you had this kind of burclave setup, because it doesn't talk about the space in between mm-hmm. them as much as it should. And, like, the fact that these roads would be crumbling and you'd be murdered as soon as you set foot out of these areas, that, like, it would look much more like Mad Max and much less like this, you know, fun version of the New Jersey, you know, NYC interchange, only there's a bunch of little bubbles that are hanging around it.
Yeah.
So I think that's the other side of the people who, like, think, oh, this is actually not as dystopian as it really should be.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, the only character that we meet in poverty is Hero Protagonist, and Hero is sort of a Thoreau-like character, right? He's a character that, because of his skills as a hacker, could get a job with any number of corporations, but decides to live in a minimalist way where he's, right. you know, all he owns is his computer and his sword.
He's yeah. like then, no like, illusions 3 years or whatever, 4 years,
not,
whenever you decide to go
choice.
Full time on the podcast. Yeah.
and our other sort of stand in for the oppressed class in Raven as a native who wants to get back at America, who nuked his people. Right. Mm-hmm. But he sort of is this super powerful god who's acting out a revenge fantasy for the whole book. So it doesn't really deal with the realities of the oppressive world that this would
right.
look
well,
like.
Except and I was gonna in the say, raft, right? Except
in the raft,
yeah, except
right? You see a lot
have
more of
a communist, or like you said, more of a state of nature kind of a universe. But yeah, the fact that the raft could be a stand-in for every spot between burbclaves is not really explored at all. Yeah.
Yeah, right, and exactly. and the only upsides in this book, as you're saying, are upsides for people with means. Like, mm-hmm. that's the thing about, like, the gated community competition resulting in great gated communities. Sure, for people with means,
right.
not for everybody else. But we are over time, and it's time to get to our After Dark segment. But we better close out this episode with our usual things. First off, preview for next week. Well, that's easy. We're going to talk about the philosophy of language components of this book, which I think will be really interesting. So Noah's sticking around for that. And then also, you've got to thank our number one patron, right, Aaron?
I do. And I have to say this one quickly for full effect. Are you ready? And Interrupting Thomas says what?
All right. If you'd like to make Aaron say stuff, make sure to go to patreon.com/zeroG. And also, you can hear us after dark. And that's it for the main episode here with No Illusions from Scathing Atheist, God Awful Movies, The Skeptocrat, The Citation Needed. Did I get them all?
You did get them all. I've got to get one more awesome. So I can tie back up with you, I think.
It's my fault.
Thank you so kindly for joining us, Noah. And we'll see you next week. Unless you're a patron, we'll see you right now for a little After Dark.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
I think what you're saying is the best we can say here is this is an attempt by some semi-woke men to try to do third-wave feminism.
And it falls
flat. Doesn't quite
yeah.
land.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
doesn't quite land.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at Zero-G Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.